From Troy Public Radio and Troy University in partnership with the Alabama World Affairs Council, this is Speaking Globally, and I'm Walter Gavan. Welcome back to Speaking Globally, where we look at the history, politics, and culture of different regions and countries around the world and talk with people who can provide context and insight into some of the most important global issues we face. In the months since Hamas's devastating surprise attack on October 7th, Israel has responded with a massive air campaign and ground offensive in Gaza. Israel ordered civilians in Gaza City to evacuate to the south, but no refuge has proven totally safe for the estimated 2 million Palestinians now packed in the territory's southern half. Speaking to NPR, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowed to eliminate Hamas. But international pressure is growing for Israel to scale back its operation as the civilian death toll continues to climb.
I think that any civilian death and the death of any child is a tragedy. And we're doing everything we can to minimize that. But Hamas is committing a double war crime. You know, it's both targeting our civilians, murdering them, mutilating them, but also hiding behind civilians as human shields. And what would you do?
Our guest today is Anton LaGuardia, diplomatic editor of The Economist. He previously served as the digital editor, deputy foreign editor, and Middle East and Africa editor. He is also a frequent broadcaster on both television and radio. On a personal note, I've had the privilege and pleasure of working with Anton in Washington, London, and Afghanistan as he covered military issues and operations in which I was engaged. Anton LaGuardia, thank you for joining us on Speaking Globally. Your 2001 book, War Without End, Israelis, Palestinians, and the Struggle for a Promised Land, was a very important source for me years ago as I tried to understand this conflict. And one of the many things I appreciated about it was the care that you took to dive into the historical roots of the present situation. I'd like to take a similar approach with our conversation. Tempting as it is to dive right into current events, let's look back at some of the major historical milestones that got us to this point. You know, really has been a war without end. I mean, I'm looking back at the 1948 War of Independence, 67 Six-Day War, 1973 Yom Kippur War, 1982 Lebanon War, the Intifadas, the 2006 Lebanon War. But it really goes back much further than that. What's a good starting place to try to begin understanding this?
Well, as somebody once told me, start with the Bible. In that, the kind of importance of these places to the collective memory of Jews and Arabs alike goes back to Holy Scripture. But I think a good point to begin the modern story would be in the First World War, when the Ottoman Empire, the sick man of Europe, as it was known at the time, enters the war on the side of the Central Powers alongside Germany. And Britain finds itself at war against the Ottoman Empire. Bits of it had already been broken away by colonial enterprise, especially in North Africa, where the French and the Italians and the British had nibbled away. But the core Arab provinces of the Ottoman Empire were now in contention. And if you remember your Lawrence of Arabia, the British were busy working with the tribes of Arabia to blow up the Hejaz Railway and try to hit the Ottomans in the soft underbelly as they saw it. And as part of that process, they did two things. First of all, the French and the British in particular sat down and began to carve up on the map what would happen to these territories when Turkey was defeated. And secondly, the British issued the Balfour Declaration, in which the British Foreign Secretary in 1917 promises a Jewish homeland for Jews in Palestine. There is a kind of caveat, as long as it doesn't, you know, impinge on the civil rights of the indigenous population. But it was clear that something was being promised to Jews. The Zionist movement had begun by then, and the British sought to curry favor with it by promising a homeland. And then you begin the, you know, the creation of the embryonic state of Israel under British tutelage, protected by British arms. Arab revolts are suppressed by the British, allowing the, you know, Zionist movement to flourish and create the institutions of what would become the state. And then, to cut a very long story short, it was a turn of Jewish groups to revolt. Initially, the right, the nationalist right, the revisionists, as they were called. And then after the Second World War, also the main labor Zionists. And Britain throws up its hands in 1947, hands the problem off to the UN, says we're leaving, and the UN partitions Palestine into an Arab and a Jewish state. And the Jewish state is created in the teeth of war, and the Arab state is not created. The bits of Palestine that remain in Arab hands are either annexed by Jordan, that's the West Bank, or administered by Egypt, which is the Gaza Strip.
That was masterful. Thank you. Let's talk about that, because, you know, we're talking about the creation of states and we're talking about land, but we're also talking about people. Give us a sense of population movements as they were taking place at this point in time in the creation of the Jewish state.
Let's take one step back. First of all, historically, there have been small movements of pious Jews who have gone to the Holy Land to lead the religious life, usually in Jerusalem. Then you have successive waves of more secular Jews as proto-Zionists who move to Palestine, usually in response to pogroms and waves of repression in Russia and in Europe, creating agricultural settlements, buying plots of land, and so on. And then with the establishment of the Jewish homeland under British rule, and then the creation of the State of Israel, you have much larger inflows of Jews from Europe mainly, and then later on from the Arab world when Israel was established. And you have an outflow of Arabs or Palestinians, depending on when you decide that Palestinian identity becomes a separate thing. But let's call them Palestinians for the purpose of this conversation, that they were inhabitants of Palestine. And they are pushed out or flee in large numbers and move to neighboring countries, or at least get out of the way of the main fighting. What then happens is that in the war of 1967, when Israel's borders are, you know, Israeli-controlled territory is tripled, a lot of these people who were refugees under the rule of neighboring countries come under Israeli occupation. So refugees in the West Bank, and especially in the Gaza Strip, were outside Israel and then kind of fall inside Israel, or at least inside Israeli-controlled borders. So you have refugees within Israeli control, and you have refugees outside in Jordan, in Syria, in Lebanon especially. And you have two waves of kind of revolt, I would say. First is the Palestinians outside, who wage armed struggle, in their words, against Israel in the hope of initiating a large war and bringing in Arab states that will finally defeat the Zionist entity, as they called it. But usually that brought them into conflict with Arab states. So in Jordan, for example, there was essentially a civil war that led to the expulsion of Palestinian militias from Jordan, and they moved to Lebanon, where they begin another armed struggle and, in a sense, precipitate the Lebanese civil war. And when Palestinian hopes of liberation from the outside fade, you see revolt by Palestinians inside Israeli-controlled territory. So in Gaza, you have the outbreak of the first Intifada in 1987, 86, 87. And then later on, you have the Second Intifada, which was a much more violent affair with guns and suicide bombs. And throughout this period, Israel is attracting Jews from around the world as its population is expanding fast. And today, you have roughly a similar number of Jews and Arabs between the river and the sea. And I use that phrase advisedly because it's become highly charged politically. But in its geographical sense, between the Mediterranean Sea and the River Jordan, including Israel, Gaza, the West Bank, Jerusalem, you have roughly equal numbers of Arabs and Jews. The distribution matters, of course. So in Israel proper, Arabs are a minority, but they form a majority in the West Bank, and they're obviously the whole population of the Gaza Strip.
And of course, religion is really key to much of this, especially in the idea of the Jewish state. And then on the other side, of course, almost all Muslim. So this is playing into it and giving it even really a heightened importance, isn't it?
The religious, political, emotional attachment to the land of both peoples is extremely strong. You have two groups of people claiming the same patch of land, which is not very big, each of whom feels it belongs to them, and they feel it in a very profound way. Jews, because it's the land of the Bible, and you don't have to dig very far to find traces of Jewish kingdoms of antiquity. And you have Palestinians who say, we've lived here for generations and we're being dispossessed or oppressed. And it is very difficult to solve the problem. And there's basically one of two ways in which you do it. One of three ways, in fact. One is that you divide the land, as happened in British-ruled India or in Ireland, usually a bloody affair. Or you share it in some kind of way, as the Belgians do between Flemings and Walloons, with sort of very complicated constitutional arrangements. Or one side dominates the other. And at the moment, Israelis dominate Palestinians. And they feel that Palestinian statehood, if it were ever allowed, would pose a mortal threat. Some Israelis feel this would be the solution. And the American administration of Joe Biden believes a two-state solution is the answer, the creation of a Palestinian state. But a lot of Israelis have a very specific experience of having tried to make peace with Palestinians and things getting worse, the terrorism problem getting worse, and the assault from Gaza on October 7th being an absolute horror. So it is very difficult. On the other hand, Palestinians say, we tried peace, and we just got more oppression and more occupation. And we got fences and borders and, Bantustanization of our territories. And, things have got worse for many Palestinians as well. So it is a conflict in which the militants on both sides have the power to wreck any attempt at peace by centrists on both sides. And that's a kind of tragedy of the Holy Land.
Indeed it is. And you've now mentioned the central event that has been dominating headlines around the world since it occurred, and that's the October attacks from Gaza against settlements, a festival, really achieving strategic surprise in a way that is astounding. I mean, that just seems so unusual given how good we have always assessed the Israeli military and intelligence apparatus to be. Any insights into how they were able to do that?
I think that in years to come, Hamas's operation, grim, grisly, and bloodthirsty as it was, will be studied for a long time in academies. And you as a military man will doubtless understand that. You study the enemy as well as your friends. I think there was a sort of triple failure on the side of the Israelis. First of all, a failure of imagination that the Gazans, that Hamas and Gaza, could mount an operation of this scale and audacity. a failure of intelligence to understand what was happening on the other side, even though it is scrutinized and observed very closely. You have to kind of go to Gaza to see the amount of reconnaissance that is involved there. And I think also an operational failure by the IDF that once the attack happened and the defenses were breached, there was a complete failure to respond. And, you know, this battalion-sized force came pouring out at multiple points and found very little resistance. Indeed, took over the main IDF bases along the border and, you know, went rampaging through kibbutzim. One report suggests they were hoping to fight their way all the way to the West Bank. So in terms of how they did it, I've heard people compare this to not a sort of terrorist attack or an insurgent operation, but something more akin to special forces, where they studied Israeli defenses, they blinded them at the outset of the attack by using drones to drop munitions onto fixed positions, you know, sort of remote controlled weapons and observation points, attacking the command and control centers that were thinly defended, attacking from multiple directions and multiple points on land, on air, and at sea, and keeping it all secret from not only the Israelis, but from their own population as well, it seems. So I think something that will be studied for time to come. Plainly, it was an operation that's been in the work for a long time, and nobody quite understood how big or audacious it would be.
I would agree with that. I, in fact, have visited Israeli outposts that were monitoring Gaza. I was there on the ground with them. And what I guess I was struck by, and this is typical, you tend to expect one thing, and so that becomes the thing that you look for. And so as you were mentioning, a failure of the imagination to envision what might happen or what would be something completely audacious and out of the ordinary, I think that's a very important point, and it will be studied, I know, again and again. Now, as we look at that, I'm going to go back to a point you made earlier about this sense of getting other countries, Arab countries, other entities, or Iran being a non-Arab country but Muslim, to rise up at the same time to inspire that. And there seems to have been something of that this would provoke that kind of general uprising. But we haven't really seen that, have we?
I think you've seen a lot of popular anger. When Palestinians fight and die, then Arab sympathies and Muslim sympathies naturally turn to them. And you've seen a lot of nervousness on the part of governments, who, many of whom intensely dislike Hamas, because Hamas is the Palestinian version of the Muslim Brotherhood that is seen as a threat by many regimes in the Arab world, not least in Egypt, which had a government run by the Muslim Brotherhood and that was overthrown by the Egyptian army. But rulers feel hamstrung in their ability to express their true desires. So they may be secretly hoping that Hamas gets clobbered, but have to sympathize with the street. And the street is, you know, almost entirely cheering on Hamas. It is interesting that in Arab television, you have seen a number of very strong interviews of Hamas figures saying, you know, what are you doing? Why are you bringing this disaster upon Gaza? And why are you building tunnels for yourselves and you didn't build air raid shelters for the population of Gaza? So you've had some quite hostile interviews as well. I agree, episodic. And the most interesting thing has been, I think, that Mohammed Deif, the military commander of Hamas, issued a video on the outset of the attack, calling on Arabs to rise up, especially calling on other groups to rise up. And they haven't done so. So the so-called Axis of Resistance, this is the network of allies that Iran nurtures around the Middle East. So Hezbollah in Lebanon, a number of militias in Syria and Iraq and the Houthis in Yemen. They have done just enough to show that they care and they're showing solidarity with the Palestinians, but not so much as to provoke the opening of a second front with Israel. And I think Hamas has been told quite clearly, you started this war without coordination. Don't expect us to come and, lose our own forces and destroy ourselves for your sake. So support and sympathy for Palestine is powerful. The number of people who are willing to sacrifice everything for Palestine around the Muslim world is limited.
Let's look at the attack itself, not so much its military dimension, but it's the effects of it. I mean, this was brutal violence that really was unleashed against civilians, women, children. There was a festival. The hostages were taken. People were murdered. You know, all of that had to be purposeful. They were obviously given free rein by their commanders to, and perhaps even orders to do that. What do you think the goal of that was? Was that to provoke perhaps an overreaction from Israel, or have you thought about that?
It is, we won't know until leaders of Hamas speak candidly about why they did this. I mean, I do not believe the story that Hamas leaders say, that they themselves were only going after military targets. And, what happened is that there was a general melee of others who came pouring out of the border and they were responsible for the atrocities against civilians. I think there's enough evidence to suggest that Hamas fighters were sent out with orders to cause atrocities and as much horror as they could. And that suggests they went out with an intent to provoke an overreaction, for to use Israel's strength against itself, which is a common enough terrorist tactic. There may also be a degree of coarsening of terrorist tactics as a result of what ISIS, what Islamic State did in Iraq and Syria, which is this very ostentatious spilling of blood and gore. Hamas were the people who, after all, introduced suicide bombing to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in the 90s. So they have a history of escalating in sort of shock value what they do. And I think it serves a dual purpose. It serves to provoke the Israelis, and it provokes to serves to show by leading example that they're the vanguard of the fight against Israel. And the response becomes so overwhelmingly, remember that, one can dispute the numbers, but many thousands of Palestinians have died in Israel's response and retribution, that the original cause is lost in the daily sight of, Palestinian built-up areas being bombed to rubble. Certainly, you see that in Arab coverage of the conflict.
That leads me to exactly what I wanted to talk about next, is the situation on the ground now. The Israelis seem fully committed, in spite of the slow going and the difficult problems with tunnels, and Hamas using non-combatants and hostages as shields, and also forcing the Israelis to take a huge toll in terms of civilian deaths to accomplish their objectives. The statistics, of course, we're getting from a Hamas-controlled agency primarily. Still, it's inevitable given the scale of the military operation and the kind of things we're seeing, that there are going to be a lot of people hurt or killed as a result. What is your impression of Israeli objectives and how long it will take to achieve them? And do they have that long?
The Israelis know from their experience that they have limited time to achieve their objectives. Limited because their army is a reserve, mostly a reserve army, and therefore there's this real economic cost to prolonged operations. And also limited by the pressure that the world puts on them to stop, particularly when they're seen as the main power and Palestinians are perceived as the underdogs. in the fighting in Lebanon in 2006, in successive wars in Gaza, you have seen growing pressure from the West, ultimately from America, saying, you know, okay, you've achieved enough. It's time to stop because this is causing trouble elsewhere and is undermining our position elsewhere in the Middle East. So they know time is limited. Now, how limited is time? They can stretch it out if they're careful about civilian casualties, or they can, you know, hasten the pressure if they're too brutal. It seems that they're being given time to make their way through northern Gaza now that the population has mostly moved to the south. But Hamas is also in the south. So the question then is, what do they do? Because there's still rockets being fired from the south. So are they going to turn south and try to clear that area out of Hamas? And what happens to the population that has moved out of northern Gaza and concentrated in the south, where they're going to put them? And I think some credit is owed to the Biden administration in helping the Israelis see that they need to be seen to do more to prevent civilian casualties and to care for the civilian population. You know, in the first days of the crisis, there's some very intemperate language from the likes of the defense minister who would talk about, we're going to have a total siege, no water, no food, no fuel, until we've got rid of Hamas. That is being tempered somewhat. There is now some aid coming into Gaza, not enough. And there's been many exhortations to be careful about how they conduct operations. And I think you've seen the rate of air bombardment diminish substantially. And the last thing the administration is urging the Israelis to do is think about the day after, which goes to the question that you asked, which is, well, can you actually get rid of Hamas? It's not just a terrorist organization. It's a political movement. It's a social movement. It's a religious idea. So it's going to be very hard to eradicate. So the question is, who runs Gaza afterwards? Can you bring in a regional peace force? Can you bring in the Palestinian Authority, which is made up of nationalist Palestinians, to take over from Gaza? And do they have the strength and wherewithal to actually control the violence? Nobody knows the answers to that, but they need to be asked and they need to be thought about. And the evidence is that this Israeli government, made up of a very right-wing mix of parties, is either not interested or doesn't have the mental space to think about what comes after.
I think the day after, whenever the day after occurs, is going to be absolutely critical to determine whether we're just leading to the next war or whether there's a chance that things will unfold differently. Is there a grand bargain to be made anywhere in this? Given the government that you just described in Israel, one would have to be pessimistic about a vision for something truly creative and innovative in that regard.
Well, the solution that, you know, Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, and others are outlining goes something like this. Israel pursues its military goal of degrading Hamas. It holds the ring, but does not remain in permanent occupation of Gaza. An international force led by Arabs comes in to replace the Israelis. And that in turn brings in a reformed Palestinian Authority, currently running bits of the West Bank, back to Gaza, so that the Palestinian Authority comes to Gaza with Arab cover rather than on the back of Israeli tanks. And that authority is sufficiently strong to run Gaza. And to strengthen it, you then need to give it the perspective of future Palestinian statehood. So a negotiation for the creation of a Palestinian state on much of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, with some kind of arrangement in Jerusalem, some kind of land swaps, and some kind of partial return of refugees. That's the formula that was being negotiated under the Oslo Accords, but never came to fruition. So it's an old new idea that out of this terrible crisis, you revive the idea of a two-state solution. Now, that's very difficult for a number of reasons. Number one, as I touched upon, attempts to create a two-state solution have made everything worse for both sides. So no one's very keen on it at the moment. The Palestinian Authority itself has lost credibility. It's seen as a a quisling of the Israelis. The Israelis have no trust in the Palestinian Authority. The other problem is that you have the spoilers on each side that have become stronger. Hamas is plainly a stronger force than it used to be. And I think settlers have become a much stronger force than they used to be. You can see it in the number of incidents involving Palestinians being the subject of settler violence in the West Bank. And does the world believe in it? You know, is the world willing to put time, effort, resources, possibly soldiers into this effort? And the Israeli government, this Israeli government, right-wing Israeli government, does not believe in a two-state solution. And a lot of Israelis believe that this conflict doesn't end, that all you can do is keep fighting. And every once in a while, you have to restore deterrence. You have to fight, you have to restore deterrence, inflict such pain that the other side doesn't conceive of attacking you again, at least for a time. And at least in the context of Lebanon and Hezbollah, it seems to have held since 2006. But that thinking has not held in Gaza. So the idea that you just do this indefinitely, I think, is also dead. So what do they put in its place? Nobody knows. Just one last thought. The one thing that hovers in the distance is the idea of a one-state solution, which is some kind of state that involves both Israelis and Palestinians, gives them equal rights with some kind of, you know, guarantees and arrangements. The problem there is that nobody's quite sure who's winning the demographic war, and Israelis will feel that they lose their very special Jewish state and Jewish statehood if they go down that road. So that also feels like a dead end in the current circumstances. So just to conclude, it's hard to see a hopeful way out.
As we wrap up here, let's take it a little bit more globally. The war in Ukraine has really dominated news up until this point, and now suddenly it's taken off, put to the side, and this is the thing that everyone is focused upon. Given the way it's diverted attention, is there any idea of whether the Russians actually had a play in this, or is that just coincidental?
I don't think the Russians had a direct play in this. There is a question as to whether Iran had a direct play in it. Certainly the Iranians have been financing, helping, training Hamas. Whether they had a foreknowledge of the timing and the scope of the operation is not clear. However, I think it is fair to say that the Russians are willing to exploit the chaos that this creates. They have welcomed Hamas in Moscow, for example. They have switched back to the old Soviet pro-Arab stance, giving up the policy of recent years of being closer to Israel. There was something of a love affair between Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, and Vladimir Putin. And I think, you know, that's now in the past. I mean, the two things touch each other in that Russia, China, Iran are aligned to some extent in their objectives to undo the American-led order, and in their own ways are challenged. America is challenged in Europe, in the Middle East, and in Asia. So there's a question here of American overstretch and American power. And lastly, that feeds into the question of America's own political dysfunction, most importantly on the question of the supplemental that the Biden administration has presented Congress for aid to Ukraine, to Israel, and to Taiwan. And Congress seems unable to pass that. And the latest continuing resolution to keep the government working, again, does not include supplemental aid for those countries. And there's a real question as to whether America can maintain its global posture given the multiple vetoes in Congress held by the more isolationist wing of American politics.
What it takes to accomplish the things that we see as important in this world, in this situation, certainly it'll be interesting to see that after the new year, whether the American Congress will fund that kind of leadership role. Well, Anton LaGuardia, it has been a pleasure having you on Speaking Globally. Thank you for your insights, invaluable as they are, into the situation in the Middle East.
It's a treat to be with you. Thank you. I enjoyed it.
My guest today has been Anton LaGuardia, diplomatic editor of The Economist and author of War Without End, Israelis, Palestinians, and the Struggle for a Promised Land. Our podcast is recorded in the studios of Troy Public Radio on the Troy University campus and is produced and edited by Austin Toy with help from Kyle Gassett. I'm Walter Gaban, and I look forward to talking with you again soon on Speaking Globally.